today I want to talk to you about Patanjali's book, which are usually referred to as the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, although this translation is called How to Know God, which sort of gives it away. It's my favorite translation, for what it's worth, if you ever want to pursue this. And one of the things I like about it is that two people were involved in the translation, one of whom was an Indian Swami, a meditator, by the name of Prabhavananda, whose teacher was a student of Ramakrishna's. So that's the general theme we're working with, Ramakrishna and what's going on with him. So these things relate to each other, and the concepts cohere with this translation. So that's one of the reasons I like it. So, the reason we're looking at this, just to be very clear about, the reason we're looking at this is earlier on when I showed you photos of Ramakrishna, or asked you to look at the photos of Ramakrishna that I posted online, I said, this person is in a state of mind called samadhi, which is a one-pointed concentration. Complete merging with the object of attention, according to the Indians. No separation between the person, Ramakrishna, and what he was meditating on. No separation at all. No self-consciousness, no subject-object, just complete unitary state of mind. So, you ask psychologists, or most people, would such a condition be possible? And they would say, seems not very likely, that subject and object distinction seems to be something that in the Western mind we believe is firmly necessary. So the idea that that distinction would be lost is probably not acceptable to most Western thinkers. Certainly was not acceptable to Hick, to go back to that. However, achieving that state is actually the desirable goal of meditation practice in the whole of Asia. Not just in India, but in the whole of Asia, primarily through the expansion of Buddhism throughout Asia over the centuries and millennia. The Buddhists carried this idea. So what Patanjali is talking about is a technology for controlling the mind, which was not original with him. It was in the tradition of India, and it spread throughout Asia. And it very strongly influenced the way religions developed in Asia. So to understand what Patanjali is talking about in a sort of fundamental mechanistic context is really necessary to understand the religious views of the largest portion of humanity historically, which has been Asian. And again, it's a radically different view than anything we accept in the West. So that's the context for you. Once again, I've said this several times, that's the context for you for why we're doing this. But I emphasize that because this is so important if one is going to understand the nature of religion outside of the Western perspective about what religion is. So I'm going to read a couple passages from here and then I'll explain them as we go through. And by the end of this talk, I'll possibly say something about how this viewpoint is different than, say, the Buddhist viewpoint in terms of its context or its philosophical framework, or we might want to say its theological framework. Or I may not have time, or I may do something else. We'll see. I may talk specifically about Ramakrishna. It just depends upon where we are and what I feel like when we get there. I mean, that's the way I lecture if you haven't figured this out yet. So the first line is simple. This is the beginning of instruction in yoga. And as I said earlier, yoga derives from the term yoke, which means union, to unite. So this is about uniting subject and object. Okay. The next thing that Patanjali says is yoga is the control of thought waves in the mind. Yoga is control of the thought waves in the mind. So we've talked about what yoga is, so I think we need to talk about what means control, what means thought waves, and what means mind, because none of this stuff is what it sounds like. First off, the word for mind is actually this word, chitta, which I called mind stuff yesterday. It's your awareness, it's your consciousness. Could be subtler or coarser, as we discussed. But the mind stuff, that which is aware, they call chit or chitta. Okay. And they say it's a phenomenon which is energetic in nature. Okay. So what does this mean, that it's energetic in nature? When we look at light, we see what we call luminosity. But if you actually look into the nature of light, as physicists talk about light, it is energy. Light is actually energy in a certain spectrum of the range of energy. And what the spectrum of the energies are high frequencies to low frequencies. And someplace in there, at a certain frequency, energy is what we call light. At other frequencies, we call it other things. So the fundamental characteristic of energy is actually, the fundamental characteristic of light is actually energy. Okay, that's the abstract concept to refer to that. And it has sort of a waveform. We know that from the way it can be described, although there are a little bit of nature problems with this, because the physicists say that it has two forms, both of which are true and incompatible, which is one of those interesting things in physics, which is to say that one theory has energy being made of corpuscles, dots, if you will, of light that sort of zoom across in rays, and the other theory has it being waves. It can't be both. I mean, you could think that it could be corpuscles with a wave-like form, but there's something about corpuscles or dots that makes that impossible. So this is all way beyond me. Yeah? They go in a straight line, just like that. Yeah, beams, that's it, beams of light. Thank you. Pardon me, took a while to get there. Beams of light. Anyhow, the main point is that what we see and the underlying nature of what we see aren't exactly the same thing, that we create a representation in our mind of something. So chitta, or this consciousness, or this mind, whatever you want to call it, is described as being an energetic phenomenon. And it has the characteristics of energy as far as the Indians are concerned. And one of the metaphors that they use for describing it is that it's like a lake, and the wind is blowing on the lake, and you see waves on the lake. And so the mind, as we experience it, is like a lake that's been roiled up by waves. That's its energetic nature, that it's moving around. So you imagine yourself as you sitting here, but now you can imagine yourself as a lake, and your consciousness or your mind is like the water, and your body is like the earth that holds the lake. Or maybe your body is like a pot, and there's water in it, and with the water there can be churned up by the wind. So what they say also is that just as a lake that is churned up by the wind will cause reflected light to scintillate, and if the lake could be calm, you would have a nice reflective image in it, say of the sun or the mountains around it or the trees on the edge of it or something like that. They say that our own minds are like that, that because our minds are moving so much, we don't have the ability really to have an accurate reflective image of what we're capable of knowing, because the image is constantly being broken up by that movement. And so you can actually see this yourself. I mean, you've seen this in playing your computer games. You can find it in sports. You see it when you're studying, doing your homework, doing almost anything, that your attention will be on what you're doing, and then it'll wander away to something else. It'll be on what you're doing, and it'll wander away to something else. So that wandering away is like that movement of the waves of the mind. So if the waves could be calmed, then the mind would stop wandering away, and it would accurately reflect what it's capable of knowing. So that's the basic metaphor. So are we good about that? Anything we want to talk about? It's not that, at that level, it's not really very complicated. Okay. Now, where it gets interesting is what they deduce from all of this. For example, the 10th line in Patanjali, so we've jumped ahead pretty far here from the 2nd to the 10th, sleep is a wave of thought about nothingness. Now, there's an interesting concept for you. Sleep is a wave of thought about nothingness. Well, remember we talked about the way in which when you're sound asleep and you're not dreaming, your sense organs aren't functioning, or they're minimally functioning. But that doesn't mean your mind is gone. Although, of course, in the West, people say that when you're sound asleep, you don't have any mind. That becomes problematic when you hook people up to encephalograph meters. Because you actually do have brainwave activity. So if brainwave activity is associated with the existence of your mind or consciousness, obviously it's there. And that would tend to support the Indian idea that sleep is a wave of knowledge, a wave of the mind, whose object is nothing at all. So it's like being in the dark cave, like if you go down in Carlsbad Caverns where there's literally actually no light, and they flip off the light switch, it's darker than you've ever experienced in your life. It was really quite an extraordinary experience. It really is. Well, your eyes are still functioning, your mind is still functioning, but there's no light, so you don't see anything. So that's what they mean when they say sleep is a wave of the mind about nothing, because there's nothing to cognize. Yeah.
What do they say about like having lucid dreams? Like being able
to control? But they didn't say dreaming. They said sleep. That means dreamless sleep is a wave about nothing. What they say about sleep is that sleep is mostly waves of memory, which you're cognizing, which are disconnected from sense experience. So lucid dreaming, though, would be to bring the sense of self-consciousness, the sense awareness, self-awareness, into that state of sleep. What that really means in practice, I don't know, because I'm not a lucid dreamer.
I've tried it.
It's very difficult. There are actually yogas in the Buddhist world. There are yogas for learning how to get into your dream state so you can change your experience of dream. And I know somebody very well who is a lucid dreamer. He's an incredibly successful businessman, made millions of dollars in the car business in California. And one of the ways I believe he was able to do that is being a lucid dreamer. He'd have these very interesting dreams, and when problems would come up, he could kind of get into the dreams and deal with the problems. And he figured out a lot of interesting marketing ideas and management ideas, mostly because of that. So he slept with a pad next to his bed. He doesn't do this anymore. He's quite elderly. He slept with a pad next to his bed and a pencil, and he would have these lucid dreams, and in these lucid dreams, he'd have ideas about what he could do to make his business more successful. And he'd wake up, and he'd write that stuff down, and then so he wouldn't forget it, and then he'd put that stuff into practice. And a lot of it worked really well. And so his wife was very aware of this also, that's what was going on. And when their business was having a hard time, I remember I was with them, she'd say, "You better do some more dreaming. We need more money here. Business isn't doing so well." So, but it was a natural talent that he had. It wasn't something that he cultivated. Now, if this is something you're very interested in, I don't know who currently is doing research on lucid dreaming, but the original research was done by someone called Stephen LaBarge, LaBarge, who was at Stanford. I don't know what's happened to his research or to him, but if you want to pursue it. And I don't really know specifically what Patanjali would say about this. I do know that the Buddhists say that the reason that they have a yoga for entering the dream state consciously is because they believe that the dreams are the product of traces of memory. Right? So when you have those kinds of dreams, if you're having issues that come up in those dreams, like you're being chased by the monster in the dream, right? Okay? Everyone's had a dream where they're being chased by a monster. So the monster represents some sort of trauma in your past. And as long as you're running away from the trauma in your past, you're running away from it. You're not conscious of it. So it's there and you're not aware of what's happening. So if you could dream lucidly, instead of running away from the monster, you could turn around and say, you're a figment of my imagination, or whatever you would do, I don't know. Or, you know, grab some sword or something and slice up the monster. And they say that the consequence of that is it resolves the trauma or brings the trauma to consciousness, and so you can deal with it. Now, how true that is, I mean, I can't attest to how true it is. I just know there is a tradition of doing these sorts of things. One thing I can say about it, this is a little bit of a divergence, but since you raised the question and we are talking about Patanjali and his ideas about the mind, for the last several months I've been very concerned and very stressed out about the situation in Japan with the Fukushima nuclear power plant, for which there are significant problems. For one thing, for 2.5 years now, it's been leaking 300 tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean every day. Now, when that first came out, TEPCO, which is the Tokyo Power and Electric Company, said, oh, no, it was only today that that happened. They got caught in that lie. 300 tons of irradiated water a day for 2.5 years. Anyhow, starting in November, if they stay on schedule, they're going to decommission the fourth reactor there. And there are a lot of people who think they're going to fail in the process because of the condition of the reactor. And if they do that, it's going to be the worst nuclear catastrophe in the history of the planet. And worse. It's already worse than Chernobyl. Yeah, they're saying that if they fail in the decommissioning effort and a couple of the nuclear rods touch each other, that Japan will become uninhabitable. And that a plume of radiation will extend all the way to Oregon. So this is really scary stuff. I'm not making this up. This is scary stuff. It's had me scared for a long time and stressed me out. I know a lot of people, such as myself, whose dreams are disturbed. Well, the other night I had this dream in which I was being chased by a monster. And it took me a while to identify what was going on there. And when I woke up, I realized that the monster was Godzilla. Now, I don't know if you remember the movie Godzilla. Perhaps you've seen it very late at night. Godzilla was the first Japanese horror movie. And Godzilla came out of the ocean, and he was created by nuclear radiation. So in my dream, Godzilla was chasing me around. Now, well, unfortunately, it wasn't a lucid dream, so I couldn't turn around and say, go away, or whatever. I spent my time trying to hide out so Godzilla wouldn't get me. Well, Godzilla wasn't 7 stories high. Godzilla was only about 10 or 12 feet high, and he didn't breathe fire, but he was pretty scary anyway. But that's not the point. The point is that that was the way my mind... Now, the consequence of this was it helped me a lot to have an image for my own fears and to try and come to grips, instead of with some amorphous fear, with something that I could identify by a fear, identify by an image, rather. So I've actually, you know, tried to cope by using that image. I mean, that's personal. I mean, you know, it might not work for you to be worried about Godzilla and being chased by Godzilla. It worked for me because I was a little kid and saw this horror movie late at night, and it freaked me out, and so that little thing is down there. So now as an adult, when I'm being freaked out by this Japanese terror, what form does it take? Godzilla, right? Well, if I could deal with that at the level it originated at, what would be the consequence? Hard to say, but it gives you an idea of what they're talking about getting into the dream space with your own conscious awareness. Okay? Is that helpful? Yeah.
It's kind of close to what his question is. What is it when you realize you're sleeping, but you're still in the dream state, but you can't really...
I don't know, actually. I don't know that I've had that experience personally, nor do I think I've read about it. Maybe it's a version of lucid dreaming, though, because you're self-conscious when you're dreaming and you know you're dreaming. That seems to me to be the door into lucid dreaming, to know that you're dreaming. That means that there's a wakeful consciousness that's associated with that experience. But I'm speculating. You know, I can't say that I've seen a reference about this, or some scientist or some philosopher or yogi or something that's spoken about. I'm just guessing. Caveat, you know. No expertise associated with that comment. Okay, back to Patanjali. So, the practice of yoga is about stilling the thought waves in the mind. And they say that it goes through progressive stages. So, for example, the 17th line says, concentration upon a single object may reach four stages: examination, discrimination, joyful peace, and simple awareness of individuality. So what that means is that when you start trying to control your mind, that the first thing, the first stage is that you're paying attention. You're examining whatever your mind is focused upon. Because your mind or your attention is always focused on something. Because we start off in the position of subject and object. So there's always going to be an object for your attention to be focused on. So the first stage of concentrating your mind on whatever object you pick, Patanjali will talk about picking objects a little bit later. The first stage is simply called examination, which is you're looking at it, you bring your mind back to it, and you look at it again, you bring your mind back to it, and you look at it again. Second stage is called discrimination. I don't frankly know what that means. It's in here, it's in the description. I mean, it's in the text. We could look for it. Then comes joyful peace, so you get some peace of mind for doing this. But the main thing is, the last stage is simple awareness of individuality, which is to say there's just the one thing there. You get to the point where there's just the one thing on your attention. Okay. So, let's jump ahead to this 18th line. It says there's another kind of concentration, which is the concentration in which the consciousness contains no object, only subconscious impressions, which are like burnt seeds. It is attained by constantly checking the thought waves through the practice of non-attachment. So now he's getting into the meat of how they practice meditation, which is you focus your mind on something, you focus your attention on something, might be a better way to phrase it. And every time your attention wanders, you simply bring your attention back to what you're focusing on over and over and over again, because the mind will be distracted, it'll wander off. It's in its nature. And so you just bring your attention back to whatever you're focusing on without a lot of stress and without beating yourself up. I know a lot of Zen meditators who beat themselves up, like, mind's wandering all over the place, you know. Look, this is the nature of the mind, to wander all over the place. What are you worried about? Why be bothered by it? That's in its nature, right? It's like you just bring your attention back to whatever you're focusing on. I mean, everybody in this room knows how to ride a bicycle. I'm going to assume that that's the case. And you know that when you were first starting to ride a bicycle, you fell off. But your big achievement in learning how to ride a bicycle was when you learned that when you're falling to the right, the bicycle needs to go to the right, and then you don't fall off to the right. And then as you start falling off to the left, the bicycle goes to the left. And eventually what happens is those gross movements become narrower and narrower and narrower movements, and you can ride a bicycle, and it feels like you're not falling over. It feels like you're going straight. But actually, what's happening is you're spending all of your time where falling to the left and falling to the right totally equalize each other in a very narrow band, and you don't fall off. But your body doesn't notice that, and therefore your mind doesn't notice that. That's actually what's happening. So that's like a good metaphor for the achievement of this concentration. Your mind goes here, or excuse me, your attention goes here off the object, it goes there off the object, but you get it closer and closer, and less frequently does it get off until it finally just stays there calmly without a lot of stress. So they say it's possible to do this. The technique for doing it is to not be attached to anything in particular, which is to say, if you start thinking about the bills, you're not worried about the bills, so you don't have the motivation to go down that line. If you start thinking about your homework assignment that's due, you don't really care that much about it, so your mind doesn't go down that line. Or the soccer match that's coming up. Win, lose, it doesn't make any difference. Your mind doesn't go down that line. It's much easier to pull your mind back to the point of concentration if that's the case. If you're freaking out about you can't pay the bills, or if you lose a soccer match, you lose your scholarship, then you're out of college, then it's going to be very hard to keep your mind focused, because there's something that's going to, I'm not saying that would be your situation, but it's very hard to keep your mind focused. So that's why he says non-attachment here. Now, if we move on.
How do you unattach from something that you deem as valuable? Just
seems like it's a part of the concept to reconcile.
You think it'd be easier to be unattached from something that you don't think is valuable?
Yeah, like if you don't care about the soccer game,
then it's easier.
Then you're like, well, I want to focus my mind on the soccer game. Doesn't really matter how it goes. I just want to think about it. Well, that's fine. But like, when you're worried about how your homework's going to turn out, like, the grade you get on the homework is a subsection of the grade you will get in the class, which is a subsection of your total GPA, which is very important.
Yes.
Like, so you might be very invested in that, and yet how do you detach yourself and just think about it in a...
It's a good question. It's a good question, which I'm not going to be able to answer. I mean, there are different ways to do it. And that would be a whole side trip discussion that would get us away from what I'm trying to do today. But let's see if I can give you a simple answer to this so we don't get too far down that rabbit hole. You need to find something that you're more attached to. And then it's easier to not be attached to the stuff that's distracting your mind. So there's a place in Patanjali where he says that the easiest way to gain this kind of concentration is to create a single thought wave on a certain subject and to hold that thought wave. Because to go from a riled up mind to a totally placid mind is close to impossible for most people. So he says that what you need to do, I'm getting ahead of this thing here, we'll find this later in the book, what he says you need to do is you develop a single thought wave about something. And hold your mind on that subject with that single thought wave. What that might be, that's hard to understand what that might be. But if it's something that's more attractive than everything else, then you won't be distracted by everything else. So the athlete that's in the zone basically has this one thought wave, which is their focus on that one something that's going on. And they're not distracted by anything else. That's why they're in the zone. There's nothing to distract them. Nothing else matters. But I'm pretty sure that if you talk to these athletes about what their experience is, there's not a strong emotionality associated with their achievement of any behavior when they're in the zone. Now, you can tell me whether you know or not. Is this true? Have you heard this? You're not sure?
A little
bit. A little bit. See, that's my sense of it, though. It's like when you're in the zone, you're not worried about success or failure. It's not like I'm going to hit that tennis ball and it's going to be just right. Then you're not in the zone, if that's what you're thinking about. If you're in the zone, it's just sort of like you're there with a tennis ball, and your relationship with it is so focused and so intimate that you naturally hit it correctly.
You know it's going to be right. Yeah,
right, right. So there's no attachment to I better hit it right or what's going to happen if I don't. Because those two options aren't part of the picture. And it's not so much that you're not going to hit it right, it's that right and not right is not part of the picture. Because that's a cognitive thing, see? The way to hit it correctly or not correctly, that's an idea. But hitting it correctly is not an idea. That just happens. Okay? That's really the best way that I can explain it. And one of the reasons it's going to be difficult for me to explain it is I've never been in the zone in regards to anything. I'm not an athlete, for one thing. And I've never gotten, well, rarely have I gotten that single-pointed attentiveness to something for a period of time. I don't know. Does that help? Hopefully. A little bit. Yeah. Okay. So these are sort of subtle things. I mean, and to fully understand what we're talking about here, you actually have to do it. Because your abstract concepts about what we're talking about are based upon the experience that you have with a rustled up or riled up state of mind. So you know what it's like to have a distracted state of mind. And you know what that feels like, and you know what that refers to, because that's where we all live. But do we really know what it means to have a focused, concentrated, one-pointed state of mind? We think we do. Because we think, well, I know what confusion is, and I know what all this, thought waves are that are all over the lake of my mind, So I know what it would be like for it to be peaceful, but actually you don't, because you never had that experience. Or if you have, you haven't had enough time to explore it so fully as to really know what it relates to, because it's kind of coming and gone away pretty quickly. And it was sort of like, wow, that was interesting. Because when you were there, you wouldn't have been in the zone anymore if you started being self-conscious about what was going on. You'd fall right out of the zone as soon as that happened. So you don't have the ability to recognize the whole process of what was happening. That's another reason why you don't really know these things. And I say you, but I mean me too, right? Because I'm just speaking about these things in the abstract. It's not like I know how to get there. Otherwise, I'd be sitting on a mountain and everybody would be coming up to see me. Hey, guru, give us the answers instead of standing here. Okay. Here's the point, though, that I wanted to get to. The 23rd line. Concentration may also be attained through devotion to Ishwara. Now, Ishwara is the term in Sanskrit for God.
Can you write that?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. I-S-H-W-A-R-A. Ishwara. Sanskrit. What's that? It's not the way you thought it'd be spelled.
Oh, no.
Yeah, of course not. It's Sanskrit. Why should you know how it's spelled? The other thing that Patanjali says, I want to read the next stanza, relevant stanza, stanza 36. Concentration may also be attained by fixing the mind upon the inner light, which is beyond sorrow. And finally, he says, let me find it here. Or by meditating on the heart of an illumined soul that is free from passion. Okay. So he says there are three ways that you can attain concentration. I mean, there are many ways, but he recommends three ways. Meditating on God. This is based on the assumption that God actually exists, right? Right. So for Patanjali, God exists. It's not like, oh, I have this idea that there might be a God someplace. I'm going to meditate on that God. No, it's more like, you place your concentration on God. Now, of course, that's an interesting question, how you can do that. You start off with an image of God, or you start off with a sound that's associated with God, like the word Om, you've heard of that in India. But the other thing you can do is you can meditate on what they call the inner light. So inner light means if you ever get detached enough from your ongoing experience to recognize that there is the experience and here is you witnessing it, you'll experience that the witnesser, the observer, is luminous, that state of mind has a luminous character, a luminous characteristic. That's the luminosity that Patanjali says you meditate on, which is to say your own pure subjectivity. So you meditate on God, you meditate on your own absolute subjectivity, or you meditate, he says, on the heart of an illumined person, which is to say, if you're a Christian, for example, you could concentrate on the image of Jesus, but you really wouldn't want to be thinking that your concentration was aimed on or that you were really caring about the image of Jesus. You care about the sacred heart of Jesus. And so that's interesting that if you actually look into the Catholic tradition, you see the sacred heart of Jesus all the time, right? Which is kind of interesting because I don't think too many Catholics are reading Patanjali. But I think that they natively understood that there was this quality that could be achieved through devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus as a practice. Now, the main thing here is, what does this devotion do? A single thought wave. Loving devotion to any of these forms of God, because that's what they are, forms of God. Loving devotion to any of these forms of God are essentially the raising of a single thought wave, because as your mind is distracted, as it will be, from whatever you're meditating on, you bring it back to that object of meditation. But this is a much more powerful technique, according to the yogis, than meditating on, say, a rock or a tree or a rainbow or a bowl. I mean, you can concentrate, you can learn to concentrate your mind by focusing it on anything. A lot of people in the 19th century recognized that you needed to have concentration to be a successful student or a successful whatever. So they practiced concentration, they practiced what we're talking about. But they practiced it with whatever was at hand. It didn't matter, because you just, whatever, it could be a chair, doesn't make any difference. But there's an advantage, according to the Indian tradition, to concentrate your mind on one of these three things. And what's the advantage of that? Well, now we really begin to look at some of the things that Ramakrishna had to say. There is a book in India called the Bhagavad Gita, Song of God, is what that means. I'm not going to write that down. You don't need to know it. It talks about yoga a lot, but it says that there are different kinds of yoga. The kind of yoga we've been talking about here is called Raja Yoga, according to this book, or the Royal Yoga. There's also something they call Bhakti Yoga, which is the yoga of love. And Ramakrishna really focused in his own personal practice and in his teachings on this yoga of love, bhakti yoga. And the reason for this is very simple. He said, what comes natural to human beings? We're emotional. What comes natural to human beings? We're emotional. Is the mind of the mother looking at the newborn child or the young child that the mother is taking care of, is that mind very focused? If the mother really loves the child, deeply loves the child, the mother's mind is one-pointedly focused on the child and the child's needs. And that's something that happens naturally. On the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, when the price of something goes precipitously down, you can see that the minds of all the traders are profoundly and one-pointedly focused on what's going on, because they're motivated by sheer terror. Right? Emotion focuses the mind, positive or negative. Emotion focuses the mind. And that's what the Bhagavad Gita is telling us. But what's the virtue of a mind that's focused by fear? I mean, it's focused, but what comes out of that? They say nothing really positive comes out of that. That just reinforces fear, right? But what about a mind that's focused through love? Like the love of a mother for a child. Or the love of newlyweds for each other, where the mind is totally focused on the beloved, as the Bible says. When you have that kind of emotion, it focuses the mind without you having to make a whole lot of effort. And of course, the mind will wander off. But then you bring your attention back because you naturally want to, because there you are with whatever it is that you're loving. You know, so why would you want your mind to be something else? This is be somewhere else, your attention to be somewhere else. This is a wonderful experience. So the Indians say, if you can develop the kind of love toward God that a mother has for a child, or that the child has for the mother, because you know how infants look at the mother. It's like their mind isn't any place else. I mean, unless they, you know, have to pee or something like that, maybe. But for some period of time, I mean, you know, the mind is right there. If they're not hungry or distracted by some other bodily function, it's like, you know, it's like it's right there at that moment. We've all seen that. We've all seen that. So the Indians say, so this is a natural human condition. Use it to develop one-pointed concentration on the object, which is, from their point of view, the ideal object to develop it toward is God. Now, we all, they say, clearly, we all don't hang around with God. It's not like I can look over my left shoulder and God's standing over there so I can have one-pointed devotion to God. But there are images, there are sounds, there are concepts. And so you can develop one-pointed concentration on those things. Because for most people, the image of God is what God is like, and is God is for all intents and purposes. You know, I mean, how many Christians, especially, you know, under duress, focus their attention on the image of Jesus when they're praying? You know, there's this saying, there are no atheists in a foxhole. right? So when you're in a foxhole under attack and you're praying for your life and you're praying to God and you're a Christian, I think it's probably the case that there's some image of Jesus floating around in that process. That's very powerful. I'm not making light of that, right? So you can use that, is what the Indians are saying. Use that quite intentionally. Now, just as an aside, this is not only an Indian technology, okay? If you talk to the Jesuits, they know about this. And they have all kinds of practices that are associated with remembering the life of Jesus or going on pilgrimage or thinking about Ignatius Loyola. Anyhow, they have they know these technologies and they use them. So these are native to human beings, but they've been very highly articulated in India. The main point, and that's what I want to leave us with, the main point has to do with Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna was somebody who achieved samadhi because his devotion to God was so strong. And this is what he talked about. He said he developed such passionate love for God that it naturally focused his mind. And the consequence of that was, first, he got the naturally single-pointed, single wave of attention, and then that subsided. Another thing that they say, that Patanjali says, is the mind is like a crystal, or consciousness is like a crystal. It takes the color or the image of what you put it next to. So if you put your mind on an image of God and become one-pointed in your loving devotion to God, then your mind takes on the image of God in that form. And eventually, you experience what's behind the form. Again, we're following Ramakrishna here. Now, Ramakrishna himself said, he didn't say this based upon, I'm going to go out and do this. He said this after the fact. He said, the love of a child for a mother is the most powerful love there is. We all have deeply within ourselves a profound love for our mother that comes from even a preverbal condition of mind. Now, I remember in the 60s and 70s, people used to talk about this. Everyone would say, God, I hate my mother. She's a horrible, monstrous person. But you didn't hate your mother when you were an infant. You may hate your mother when you're 25 or 30 because she cut you out of the will or God knows whatever else happened. But when you're an infant, you didn't hate your mother. You loved your mother. If you can go back to that condition of that quality of loving of the mother, that would naturally focus the mind. Now, we would say, so what's that got to do with God? Because we think of God as being like a father. But in India, God is not only male. In India, God is also female and also impersonal. So Ramakrishna happened to find himself in a temple where the image that was worshipped in the temple was called Kali, which is God in female form. So it naturally happened that he could develop childlike devotion to the mother. And that's what we will talk about tomorrow. Yes?
I know you don't like to watch a lot of TV, but you should watch Supernatural because it talks about all of the gods.
Supernatural?
Mm-hmm.
But where would I find it?
You could find it on Netflix.
Oh. Alrighty. And it's a series called Supernatural?
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty.
It's a drama, but they mention a bunch of the...